Hi, I hope everyone's doing well. For this presentation, I want to give an overview of some of the ethical and epistemic issues that Indigenous people have been dealing with in the realm of climate science. And so I'm going to talk a bit about my background, why I'm interested in climate change and climate science from an Indigenous perspective, and then go into a number of philosophical issues and show exactly how it is that Indigenous people are trying to advocate beyond just showing that their knowledge of climate change is legitimate in the eyes of scientists, and actually creating their own knowledge institutions for better providing the information they need to prepare for climate change. So to begin with, why am I interested in climate change? Well, I'm a member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation, and back in the day, that's where we lived, lower part of the Great Lakes. That's how much land we ceded to the United States. You can see that we had a fairly large area. And we had a system that was totally different from the United States. So we lived seasonally, and unlike the US, where you've got the same old government all year round, we actually had governments that shifted depending on the season to accommodate the combination of plants and animals that you had to harvest, monitor, and so on. And so our system is extremely adaptive, and the locus of political authority at one time of the year could have been the family, but at other times it was large bands, and it was constantly moving and changing according to the ecosystem dynamics. And so you can imagine an idea like climate change to us, if the English language word existed at the time, wouldn't have been very new. We were thinking a lot about seasonal change and remembering year in and year out what those changes were. So we also had a long-term memory of what the climate system was doing according to the ways in which we observed it. And so in some of my early work with Nick Rio, I've actually tried to look in detail about how these systems were not based on regulatory incentives, but were political systems based on kinship structures, and where knowledge actually wasn't understood as something that belonged to an individual or to a human, right? Humans were actually sort of steward of knowledge that was in other places. In fact, it's kind of offensive to talk about humans as being knowers, because we're actually not worthy to be a knower in our culture and in our political system. And all that was going great, and then this happened. We're always trying to say that we had it harder than the Cherokees, so where they call it the Trail of Tears, we call ours the Trail of Death. And we actually were forced by military escort to move from the Great Lakes region all the way down to Kansas and eventually into Oklahoma. And so in a lot of ways, right, we're like the first kind of climate change relocation survivors, because we literally, in a very short period of time, had to shift from one climate region to the next in completely different areas, right, in the 1830s, 1840s. And so for me, being from a tribe that was relocated from the Great Lakes, the idea of what it means to adapt to change is extremely important, especially ecological change. You can see they stuck us with a bunch of the other Great Lakes tribes right in the middle of the state. And even though Oklahoma is not the prettiest place, as you guys can imagine, we've completely rebuilt our nation and learned how to live in this ecosystem and rebuilt our government institutions. We've blended Western styles of government with traditional styles of government. We've kept a lot of our culture and traditions. And so it's been an important part of my life then to do philosophy and to be an academic within this context of Indigenous nation rebuilding. And so some people refer to me as a scholar activist, but actually I just do philosophy in the way that we've done it for thousands of years in my tribal community. And so when Christy Dotson, my partner, and I played the philosophy job market lottery, and we actually wound up right here, where there's three other Potawatomi nations who didn't go to Oklahoma, I was like, I can work with this. I can do this. And so I've been a major advocate of conservation in the Great Lakes region. If you're Potawatomi from Oklahoma, all the plants and animals that are part of your culture don't exist in Oklahoma. So when I was in a place where they actually did exist, you know, it was awesome because you could participate in all of the activities that you only hear about if you're coming from Oklahoma, activities that you could only practice in particular environments. And then what happened is I was talking to some climate scientists, and they actually showed me this. They said that the climate in Michigan in a certain amount of time would actually be like the climate in Oklahoma. And that was just like, that just weirded me out. I was like, they're going to do whatever it takes, right, to get us to Oklahoma. even if it means moving to Oklahoma to Michigan. And so I felt like, you know, just at the time when I was able to engage with these plants and animals, they were actually going away. They were going to move north. They were going to move into Canada. And the entire fabric of our society that remained in the Great Lakes region was eroding right before my eyes. So for me, climate change became a serious issue, not just because of the legacy of our nation having to switch climate regions, but because all these other Potawatomi-related groups were part of the Anishinaabe group were also facing serious climate change aspects that were going to affect their culture, their economies, and so on. And so this got me on to trying to understand, well, how is it that we can understand the ways in which tribes or the challenges that tribes face with respect to climate change, and then what can we do to best prepare to deal with climate change and understand climate change. And so I found out that it wasn't just tribes in the Great Lakes, it was indigenous people all over the world that have to deal with climate change. So for example, in the Pacific Northwest, the Nisqually's are watching a glacier melt. As the glacier melts, it affects the fish habitat, it affects their salmon. They depend on salmon culturally and economically. The village of Kivalina in Alaska is among a long list of Alaska Native villages that's going to have to permanently relocate due to sea level rise, which is induced by climate change. And even scientists, starting about 10 years ago, began to document the fact that indigenous people are actually going to be hit harder by climate change than other groups. And so reports in the United States, you know, where scientists synthesize articles and research findings, actually are all showing that indigenous people are subject to a number of issues, whether it's relocation, to loss of culture, to economic damage, and that indigenous people are going to face these changes quicker than other populations. Some indigenous people, especially in the very climate-sensitive regions like the Arctic and the Pacific, are experiencing these things right now. And so a part of my work looks at climate injustice, so understanding why these things are particularly wrong and target indigenous people in ways that favor settler colonialism and other colonial forms of power. But in this presentation, I want to talk about climate science and indigenous people. And so one of the things that happened is when I tried to figure out, well, how can I get more involved with understanding what climate change is and how it's going to affect indigenous people, one of the first groups that I turned to was the Indigenous Peoples Climate Change Working Group. This is a group that started about 10 years ago. It's run by tribal college students. And their goal was actually to figure out how, as young people, they could prepare their communities to deal with climate change. And one of the things they told me that now I know very well, but at the time it hadn't dawned on me, was that as Native people, we know a whole hell of a lot about climate change, right? Because if you look at this, this is my friend Shannon McNeely put this together with the Koyokong, which is indigenous people in the Arctic. Our seasonal lifestyle meant that we gained a ton of knowledge about how things were changing and shifting. And in addition to this kind of knowledge, right, we also kept records. So these are the Lakota winter counts that go way back hundreds of years, keeping track of climatic events, meteorological events, and scientists have actually been able to corroborate those with their own findings. And so indigenous people knew a whole lot about how the climate system was changing and had a kind of historical location and, you know, sort of in situ situation that provided privileged forms of knowledge about how a particular area had changed. And the Indigenous Peoples Climate Change Working Group also told me that scientists were realizing this too, and that scientists were beginning to understand that indigenous people had forms of knowledge about climate change that scientists themselves didn't have access to with some of their tools, like aerial photography or satellite imagery. And so the people in the working group were basically telling me, look, wouldn't it be great if indigenous people and scientists could work together? I know there's the whole trust thing, right, between people and colonial institutions, indigenous people. Wouldn't it be great to try to figure out whether there could be a collaboration that would benefit indigenous people's capacity to be prepared for climate change? And so we began to look at a number of different ways in which scientists were talking about indigenous people's climate change knowledge, right, to sort of get inside their heads and see what they were doing. So, right, you see examples like this, right, where Navajo people have historical knowledge of declining snowpack and changes in precipitation. If you're a scientist and haven't lived in that region at all, this is very valuable information. Native people write because they constantly have to shift depending on conditions. They actually have knowledge of how to change, you know, what you plant and what you harvest. And that could be used when similar changes to those that happened historically happen today. You also have the case where indigenous people's knowledge is extremely fine-grained. So in this case, scientists were trying to understand whether wind was becoming more or less predictable in a certain area. And they literally just had one little weather station, which was in a flat area by the airport, and they completely disagreed. They said that there wasn't changes occurring in the wind patterns. The native people there said that it was. And the native people were using, I think it was over 15 different variables to measure, right, whether the wind was changing, including things like snowpack and movement of animal populations. And so it turned out that they were right, and that indigenous knowledge, right, of the climate system had all sorts of insights that scientists had not yet been able to understand. And so it's no surprise, right, when you're thinking about the kind of knowledge you have to live seasonally. And for us, like in my tribe, for example, and this is an example from a group within our same culture, so Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, basically the same group with some regional differences. But when scientists tried to work with some people in our community, right, they found out that the particular kind of knowledge that was used for survival was extremely different, right? So scientists initially in English wanted to know what we actually call these different aspects of the ecosystem. And so they wanted basically, what's the term in your language for what these things mean? But elders in this community quickly reminded them that actually indigenous people don't refer to these things as discrete sort of ecological entities, but they refer to them, this is the translation of that last one, in terms of what people are doing with them, right? And so you wouldn't actually talk about something in terms of blueberries, or you wouldn't talk about, you know, something in terms of water, right? You talk about the particular harvesting activity that went along with it. Moreover, the actual way in which you communicate embeds language or embeds information about who told you that or where you found that out that you can't translate into English. So somebody in English might say, oh, I learned that from somebody else. But in the actual language, our language, right, in Anishinaabe language, that sentence or that couple of sentences would actually tell you what particular person told you that and what that person's level of credibility is, right? And so it's a very detailed sort of linguistic understanding of knowledge. Moreover, you didn't even refer to the same thing as that thing all year round, right? Depended on what stage it was in. So if you're talking about something that's being burned, depending on what time of year it was, that's what you'd refer to it as. So you can imagine that if your language operated like this, you'd have an extremely important kind of knowledge. That's a knowledge that has allowed us to survive, even in its contemporary instantiations today, where we rely on a lot of different Western technologies and institutions and so on. And so when we think about indigenous climate knowledge, this is sort of the context that we're thinking about. So it's no surprise when the people in the working group were telling me, we know a whole hell of a lot about climate change. Wouldn't it be great if we could take the types of things that we know, link up with climate science? And you can see, right, the result of that understanding was that numerous scientific organizations, whether it's the Arctic Impact or Climate Impact Assessment or federal policies through the Climate Science Centers, international policies for UNESCO, they all built up literature that said that these two knowledge systems need to work together. And indigenous people as well began producing literature, such as their own climate change plans, and groups were forming like the United League of Indigenous Nations, and declarations like the Mandaluyong Declaration. You know, all this were saying that these knowledge traditions need to connect with one another, or with each other. Then came the literature that heavily criticized the way in which scientists were using terms like indigenous knowledge or traditional knowledge or traditional ecological knowledge, which are just sort of synonyms for the indigenous knowledge that I was talking about. And this literature then actually posed questions that the way in which scientists were referring to indigenous knowledge, there was something about it that actually disempowered indigenous people. And a lot of Native people I was talking to, kind of thinking about this literature, were saying, we feel that when scientists refer to our knowledge systems, that they just want data from us, and they don't actually want to work with us to better understand how to prepare for climate change. And so when this literature, as you can see, some of it, you know, goes back to to the 90s with respect to other environmental issues and conservation and natural resource protection. But as a lot of this literature really started emerging in 2008, 2009, 2010, and on, right, I began really puzzled, how is it that we can understand why it's the case that Native people are so offended by the way in which scientists are referring to their knowledge systems? And so when I looked at a number of different definitions or a number of different sort of conceptual formations that came out, right? So scientists tended to refer to indigenous knowledge in terms of, you know, what it could do for climate science, right? So this knowledge contributes to climate science, you know, by offering, and it mentions a list of things that are similar to what I talked about before, you know, but nowhere in this does it talk about indigenous people's own governance, you know, their own understanding of how they need to adapt to climate change, rather just highlights what it can do for climate science. You know, here too, right, you can provide research, you know, and so you see sort of the language that favors what indigenous knowledge can do for climate science. In other cases, right, you get terms, and I'll talk a little bit about this later, where indigenous knowledge is only actually looked at as in situ, right? It's only looked at as knowledge that's highly local in character, but doesn't have the potential for broad application like climate science does. And again, I'll talk a little bit later about why that's relevant. This is another assumption that indigenous people are concerned about, right? Science is situated within the global, and indigenous knowledge purely within the local. Another thing you get, right, is that indigenous knowledge is really only relevant when it's closely linked to a particular culture or set of surroundings, right? So the idea is that indigenous knowledge is not something that can participate at a regional level or a continental level or a global level, and that the ultimate impact is for the global community without any reference to what indigenous knowledge means for indigenous people as they attempt to prepare for climate change. Another assumption that you get, right, is that indigenous knowledge can only be understood as valuable within it the particular culture, right, that it arises in, right? It doesn't have any possibility of being valuable in any additional kind of context. And by the way, these last two don't have citations because they're from the previous one, which is the Arctic Climate Impacts Assessment. And then finally, again, right, this sort of weird distinction between culture and knowledge, which based on stuff I was telling you before, would strike an indigenous person as very strange, right? But here the scientists are apologizing for the fact that indigenous knowledge is conveyed through an indigenous culture, indigenous language, and trying to reassure these scientists that it still is valuable, you know, even though it's embedded within a particular culture. And obviously for people in science studies and some areas in philosophy of science, right, the idea that science is somehow separate or detached from culture is considered to be highly problematic. So, I mean, that's obviously going on in the background as an indigenous knowledge is seen as heavily associated with culture, whereas scientific knowledge is somehow seen as having a utility that's detached from culture, right? And then you sort of get the, you know, statements that literally talk about how it's the responsibility of indigenous knowledge to help other people manage themselves with respect to climate change. You get different versions of this as well, right? This one's loaded with calls for help. Indigenous people can offer us, you know, appreciate, encourage all of us to expand. And so this is kind of just a quick run through, and there's many other examples of this. And so a lot of indigenous people said, we can contrast these ways of talking about indigenous knowledge with the way in which we try to articulate it in English. Because obviously, as you guys know, one of the strange things is that most indigenous languages don't have sort of a discrete term like knowledge. And so indigenous people, when they would articulate kind of creolizing things in English, they would actually talk about knowledge in a way that's very different from what I was just showing you before, right? So here's Deb McGregor's definition. Traditional knowledge, TEK is just the acronym for traditional ecological knowledge, involves the relationships among knowledge people in all creation. It's viewed as a process of participating, a verb, and this is key because she's from a similar linguistic group that I'm from, and our language is, I think it's like 80% verbs. Like the whole thing is verbs, whereas like English, the percentage is like much, 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 much less, right? Rather than specifically as the knowledge gained from such experiences, for Aboriginal people, you know, indigenous knowledge is not just about understanding relationships, It is a relationship with creation. It's something that one does. And so here there was sort of this contrast, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change noted that there were language and sociocultural barriers which were making it tough to actually integrate the two different knowledge traditions. And so when I tried to understand what was going on, I found that if you look at all of these different definitions and sort of the total body of literature where scientists try to define what indigenous knowledge is and how it contributes to climate science, what you find are three assumptions that are very, very hard to defend in ways that don't actually help indigenous people in any way, right? So the first thing is when traditional knowledges are referred as primarily as data. Well, that's nice that they're considered to be legitimate data. Because they're detached from the actions or the doings of indigenous people, it means you can work with indigenous knowledge without working with any indigenous people. Or you can have a very short-term relationship with indigenous groups, right? And so going back to this example from the Koyukon, if this is how you thought about your knowledge system, right, it's not actually something that somebody could say that they interact with or gain anything from unless you were there working alongside of them. You know, so the idea that there's something as knowledge that's separate from the actual doing of it is seen as offensive because it gives scientists legitimate reason in their eyes to then not work very closely with indigenous people, not actually work collaboratively. And this is one of the things that I found. The second distinction, right, is that, you know, traditional or indigenous knowledges, TKS is just, again, like another short for indigenous knowledge. So traditional knowledges and science are completely separate. So this goes back to those definitions where they're saying, you know, science is science and indigenous knowledge is only valid within this very particular culture or location. And so there, what was problematic about that is it completely erases the fact that most indigenous people in North America, but also in other parts of the world, have adapted quite a bit to colonialism. They use Western forms of government that are heavily based on scientific evidence that looks a lot like Western science, and that their indigenous knowledge is actually braided with a number of other traditions of knowledge production. And so it completely ignored the fact that indigenous knowledge was working at the scale of not only tribal governance, but regional governance when tribes worked together and shared information, but also, right, that they were using technologies that were trying to understand how the global phenomena of climate change as measured through Western tools was related to what indigenous people knew on the ground, right? So if you look at a government system like this, it's extremely Western, but if you talk to people in the Oneida tribe, which is what this comes from, they'll tell you about how their own traditional knowledge systems actually structure the way in which they do science. So that idea that they're sort of completely separate completely erases this reality. It also erases the reality that historically indigenous knowledge systems were complementing each other through trade. There were huge regional trade networks that sustained particular indigenous groups. So it wasn't just that your indigenous knowledge was somehow local or in situ, right? You also had massive knowledge exchange. It also obscures what I looked at a lot in my early work with Nick Rio, which was the fact that in any current seasonal indigenous system, there's always the incorporation of Western technology, Western science, right? If you're talking about white-tailed deer hunting, they're white-tailed deer hunters that do it seasonally, also depend on all sorts of scientific studies and so on, which make perfect sense to them in terms of how they improve their capacity to hunt. So that's kind of the second one. Now the third one, right, is there's people that say, okay, the best way to solve these types of problems is actually to say they're both like empirical traditions. They both have different standards of peer review and so on for credentialing knowledge. So why don't we just call them all science? Or why don't we just call them all knowledge? And as appealing as that is, right, because in a certain level that's exactly true, but what indigenous people oftentimes want to say is that it's also problematic because it gives scientists the impression that when they work with indigenous communities, that their own protocols and mannerisms and ways of being are appropriate in those contexts, right? So for example, indigenous knowledges actually are tied to very specific ways of, like, very practically, how you handle particular animals. And so scientists who see animals as instinctual or as objects and so on might not handle animals the same way. They might put collars on them or do other things that are offensive to indigenous people. So they're right, if you just called them the same thing, and said, it would give kind of the wrong impression, right? We want to call them different things while respecting the fact that, empirically speaking, these knowledge systems have a lot to contribute, right? So in a paper that I published, we talked a lot about the fact that even though indigenous people have protocols which do things like grant non-aid or agency to non-humans, there's no reason why those particular protocols, and in scientific protocols where you don't have that kind of agency going on there with respect to plants and animals, there's no reason why they can't work together, but they actually need to respect each other as having very different approaches to how we understand the world. So basically, all of this kind of left me with the idea that you can never actually define or identify the difference between science and indigenous knowledge. It just can't be sustained. There's no sort of English language definition that could actually give you a clean distinction. There's additional other things for that. And especially in the context where scientists are, you know, particularly privileged to the colonial system against indigenous people, it's also problematic you could actually find an English language articulation that would support or empower indigenous people. So with these things in mind, what indigenous people have actually done is not sought then to find an English language way to articulate the value of their knowledge. What they've actually tried to do is a number of other approaches to protect their capacity to work with climate scientists and to braid their knowledge with climate science in ways that weren't harmful to them. And so one of the first things that came up was that because scientists oftentimes don't accept this idea that indigenous knowledge is always about doing, they didn't actually realize that in climate change situations, there were risks that indigenous people face when they share knowledge with climate scientists. So for example, if an indigenous group has a treaty area that's highly contested by the settler state, so the state of Washington or the state of Michigan, then a lot of what you have to do to continue harvesting in those areas is keep secret where certain plant and animal populations are, because if you divulge where they are, then they're going to get pillaged or they're going to get restricted. And so in these cases, if you were talking to an elder about climate change in a particular area and that elder gave you the history of change, and that history, right, included the movements of plant and animal populations, and that study was published and went public, right, then for people who have been trying to figure out where those plant and animal populations are, that would then create the potential that you would lose access to those plants and animals. And so a lot of climate scientists didn't realize this, that actually indigenous knowledge operates within this larger kind of governance situation in which there actually are risks to knowledge exchange. So on the Federal Advisory Committee on Climate Change and Natural Resource Science, we have kind of a tribal team. And what we've actually worked to do is create guidelines for scientists that require them to talk about and understand the risks of what they're doing, even when their own academic institutions do not hold them to those standards. So the last report our committee produced to Secretary of Interior has extensive sections in it on the risks posed to indigenous people. And we formed a group called the Climate and Traditional Knowledges Work Group, which produces a number of literature aimed at protecting indigenous people from the risks of knowledge exchange. Now, one of the things that's important about this is that this isn't a consent approach that that is taken sort of from medical ethics or from another area. It's actually a consent approach where indigenous people at all times define what their knowledge is, they also define what the risks are, and they also have to be at the ground level of the creation of any research. You know, so the understanding of consent is not that you hear information about what the risks are. That's not early enough consent. Consent actually involves conceptual involvement in the actual process of developing research. And so kind of the first sort of level that you see indigenous people advocating within climate science, you know, concerns kind of this policy level. How do you build in stronger forms of consent within federal policies, right, that fund climate science, that want to see collaboration between indigenous people and climate scientists? This policy work then is gone to the sort of congressional and statutory level. A group that I participate in called the First Stewards Symposium. It meets every 2 years in Washington, D.C. There's usually a congressional hearing. We're trying to have another congressional hearing this year on indigenous issues with respect to climate change. It brings together indigenous people from all over sort of the U.S. settler sphere. And it's sort of a, you know, it's a large event. A lot of policymakers come to it. One of the groups that is related to this that I'm part of formulates language for policy that eventually goes into the rules of federal agencies. It goes into statutes. It goes into other aspects of federal policymaking. And so here too, right, we've worked to include language that has a strong notion of free, prior, and informed consent in relation to indigenous knowledges, and that indigenous knowledges have to be acknowledged, respected, and promoted in federal policies and programs. We have further sort of detailed language that talks about what that means in the sense that I've been referring to before. And so this is sort of kind of, you know, a policy aspect of how indigenous people have sought to work within the federal programs for making sure that indigenous knowledge is at least discussed. But the plot thickens, right? Because it's not enough just to have sort of these highly formulaic policies. We also have to improve the language of how indigenous knowledge and indigenous ways of knowing are actually discussed. So one of the key issues that comes up, right, is gender. For indigenous people, you can't talk about climate change impacts without talking about gender. And when indigenous people talk about gender, you have to remember we don't have the kind of the binary gender system with all the discomfort about the in-between that you have in the US, right? We have completely different understandings of gender that don't map onto that. So the way we talk about how climate change impacts indigenous communities, right, and the way in which people who have indigenous knowledge talk about those climate change impacts is, you know, sort of is contextualized, you know, against a completely different way of understanding gender. So this is a Forest Service report that I was part of, and the thing about these reports is that you have to produce a glossary. The glossary has to be approved by the agency, and then once those terms actually get approved, then they become sort of part of the lexicon of how that federal agency investigates issues like climate change. So for our report, this is our glossary. It has terms that the federal government has never seen before, right? It's an official term, right? LGBTQ with two-spirit, patriarchy, which is a key notion that indigenous people have, struggling against patriarchy, two-spirit. And so here, right, trying to actually expand the way in which agencies discuss things has been a key point of advocacy. Now, going even further, indigenous people have realized that part of what throws climate scientists off is that when they engage with indigenous knowledge, because they still think about it as data, they don't understand sort of the larger governance framework that indigenous knowledge is part of, and they don't actually understand how indigenous people think that climate science itself should be organized for their own benefit. So there's a lot of indigenous groups that I've been part of that what we've actually tried to do is sort of turn the tables on non-native scientists. So this is the logo from a group called the Rising Voices of Indigenous People in Climate Science. And what this group tries to do is to get scientists to understand the fact that when indigenous people think about how to organize knowledge, the knowledge about climate change, they actually think about it in the same way that you think of how to organize a ceremony, right? Where there's a lot of implicit understanding of what people are supposed to do, where there's a lot of respect given, right? Where there's a number of different facets that actually go into a ceremony. So a knowledge production process is ceremonialized. So what this group does is meets every year at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and these are the Rising Voices. And even though it's in a major scientific institutions, the entire space and protocol of the event is designed in ceremonial terms. And so the scientists that show up to this to have dialogue with indigenous people about how it is that they can work together in ways that empower indigenous people, they do it in a space where they can see kind of the markings of science going on, of what they understand science to be, but then the protocols and some stuff on the wall or some ways in which people are sitting or talking is totally different. It's more like something you'd find in a tribe. And so here the idea, right, is to convey that governance context that's part of indigenous knowledge. You actually have to retrofit that space. And so we've had about three of these. We actually have our fourth one. It's going to be in Hawaii this year. So we're going to have it a different venue, right? These are all kind of indigenous organized, indigenous led events that occur within scientific institutions. to try to convey something that's very hard to explain about how, for indigenous people, knowledge is ceremonialized, or the knowledge production process is ceremonialized. And we've done recommendations and other things to the government about collaboration between climate science and indigenous knowledge. One of the key things we've done is they make us do an evaluation of it. And so this year, for the first time, we created an indigenous evaluation process, right? So instead of just measuring like the boring stuff, like professional relationships, we measure actually things like whether the ceremonial space created more family-like relationships. We're kind of successful at that. Another thing that you see even going further is that it's not just retrofitting the scientific spaces, but getting scientists actually out to see what indigenous people are doing in their own nations. So a lot of my projects are with the Sustainable Development Institute of the College of Menominee Nation. The Menominee are well known. They didn't like the sustainability models that other people created, so they made their own, right, to try to understand their experience adapting to change over time, especially in relation to colonialism. And so what we actually do is create scientific events there that are like no other. So these are events where scientists actually have to come to the tribe and talk about climate change in a context that's totally foreign to them. So this is the Shifting Seasons Summit, and we've hosted there, Menominee's beautiful place in the Great Lakes region. It's totally, you know, again, ceremonialized, and we do some boring scientific stuff. But the key, right, are these dialogues where people talk about things that you typically don't talk about in scientific conferences, right? We actually talk about colonialism and how scientists are actually responsible for ensuring that the work that they do doesn't promote settler colonialism. And so there's a number of different topics, and oh, I wasn't supposed to show you that. That's where I'm falling asleep when an elder's talking, but that's even going further, indigenous people are making their own climate adaptation plans. They're using federal funding and funding from other sources to create their own plans for adapting to climate change. But the way they do it is by actually making sure that their own knowledge systems are sort of in the lead in terms of how the scientific research gets structured or how it gets interpreted. And oftentimes what's interesting is that when indigenous people engage in these plans, they differ with scientists, because whereas scientists are always looking for more information, more data, a lot of times indigenous people say, we have enough data and information, we want implementation at this point, right? And so there's oftentimes a bias, right, where scientists are constantly, you know, saying that we're only going to work with you guys, you know, unless we can get more data. But actually scientists have an extremely valuable role to play just within implementation. And so I actually formed teams of tribal college students and others from Menominee to work with specific tribes on how it is that their adaptation plans can be democratized so that people who are traditional knowledge holders can structure those plans, and so the scientific research doesn't actually, you know, draw off of indigenous knowledge in a problematic way, but is actually used in ways that empower indigenous peoples. So this is one of the plans that we worked partially on with the Red Lake tribe. And so you can see the whole plan starts off with their traditional way of knowing, their traditional relation to the environment, their seasonal government system and way of life. And I still, when I work in these teams, haven't figured out a traditional knowledge approach to not having my cheese curds stolen. Indigenous people are also just sort of cutting out engagement with a number of different Western institutions and talking together about their experiences working on climate change and braiding indigenous knowledge and climate science. So this is a group that was actually hosted by the UN Institute for Training and Research. It's 32 different indigenous representatives, and all actually talking about climate change and a number of different issues and how they as indigenous people can work together. So here it's not mediated necessarily by scientists, but indigenous people creating their own dialogues. And this has actually been a very powerful process. This is a group I was part of hosting. It's a Maori Iwi, the Walpole Island First Nation on the Canada side and the Grand Traverse Band on the Michigan side, all spending time in each other's nations, talking to each other just about what knowledge means, how to work with climate scientists, completely, you know, not mediated by a scientific organization. And so here the idea was how to actually build autonomous knowledge institutions instead of always relying on mediation with science. And we do a little joke, this river is called the Boardman River in English, but it's really supposed to be called the Ottawa River. So when the Maoris visited it, we actually had them nail in the new name. So when we got busted for it, the Maoris were already gone to New Zealand and they couldn't get caught. Another group that I'm part of is the FIRST Network, which stands for Facilitating Indigenous Research, Science, and Technology. And we actually just met yesterday in Alaska. And so for this group, it's the very same process, right? How do we actually build our own knowledge institutions? And so you can see that these are lively discussions, generate all sorts of information. One guy said, because we're oral traditions, we shouldn't write stuff down. He said, make sure to write that down. He was joking, of course. And so these things, right, in these different events where we actually talk about climate change and knowledge, right, we produce our own models. And these models, right, then end up being formal models that are used for Indigenous people to engage in climate change adaptation and work with climate scientists on their own terms, right? You can see what happens when I leave the room. They assign me tasks that I don't even know about. Let Kyle White do it. So to give you an example, to close, so here, right, and thinking about that drawing I showed you, which we haven't turned into something formal, but so Maori people formed this model called the Mori model, which is their kind of conception of collective well-being. So Mori and Maori are not the same term, even though they look a little bit similar. So notice how, so this is a way of describing sort of their seasonal lifestyle, their way of understanding well-being in a sense you can't really convey with the English language. So then what they do, right, is they also want to be able to communicate that in ways that are more familiar to climate scientists. So based on that model, right, then they make it a little bit more quantitative in that sense, right, and figure out ways to actually measure how a particular climate change impact increases or decreases more. Right? It's not about, oh, this harm, you know, or this or that, right, or this economic loss or this damage. It's about whether that increases or decreases Mori, right? Which Mori is similar to a term we have in our tribe called Bamatsuin, which refers to kind of the overall functionality of that seasonal system. It's like saying, understanding climate change in terms of whether it increases or decreases that. And so they have all these ways of actually understanding how to put that in terms that could be more familiar to scientists. And not just because they want to work with scientists, but because there's value for themselves in using quantitative terms, right, to sort of augment what they're doing. And then finally, the Menominees, which I was telling you before, they developed the notion of sustainability for climate change adaptation with six dimensions. They developed it out of their own experience adapting to colonialism and environmental change, right? So they see Menominee Autochthony at the center of that. And they use it actually to structure scientific research and develop hypotheses, right, because it looks kind of like a honeycomb, and you can understand complex problems, right, like changes in forestry, by putting together all these different human, ecological, environmental dimensions together, understanding all those complex relationships, and then using that to ask questions about how to, say, manage your forests. And so this is part of the reason why you can actually see their reservation from outer space, right? You see that big green patch in the middle, and everything else is either, you can see kind of the Northwoods starting, but then sort of commercial and recreational farming there, right? It's because they've actually preserved a sustainable forestry operation based on biodiversity using their own kind of model of thinking about planning. And so the next steps, right, have been to work with young people about how do you do this stuff. And so this summer we're having a couple of workshops for young Native folks about how to actually engage in programming, right, where it's based on our knowledge sovereignty, it's based on developing our own conceptions of climate change and climate science and working with climate scientists in ways that empower us. This is another one we're doing. And these are some of our classes from past years. And so I think what we see here then, as the last point I want to make, is that for Indigenous people, all of those other ways of thinking about Indigenous knowledge in relation to climate science are just about supplemental value. There's how what we know can supplement what climate scientists do. But for us, right, Indigenous knowledge is about governance. It's about our own capacity to adapt, to manage for climate change. And because of that, right, for scientists, when they work with us, it's not really about them trying to meet ethical requirements in terms of how to get data from us, but actually it's more of a diplomatic relationship. They have to understand the governance context that we operate in and actually have to have the same skills that somebody who serves in a diplomatic role has to actually serve. And so a lot of the initiatives that I was showing you before sought to build that diplomatic capacity in scientists. Thank you.